I used to like to go to parties and take my wang out.
Oh.
Yeah. Did you?
Me too, yeah. Hello and welcome to The Write-Up. I'm Owen Edgerton. The Write-Up is a KUT-produced program featuring writers, the books they write, and the lives that they lead. And we are grateful today because we have playwright and novelist Kirk Lynn.
It's a terrible thing to be a man.
It's a weird thing. I used to think it really funny to come up to someone and put it on their shoulder.
We were so similar. This is amazing.
Kirkland is a gift for voice. Whether he's writing the voice of a new mother, a teenage runaway, or one of the founding fathers, Lynn has a way of capturing their personality. In his plays and novels, the audience or the reader forgets that the writer's there and instead just experiences the character. Lynn is a playwright, novelist, university professor, and one of six artistic directors of the Rudmechs who have been producing plays in Austin, Texas for two decades now. We are thankful to have on the show today, Kirk Lynn.
I'm so glad that the internet didn't really exist when I was when I was at my wildest.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, I'd never be a professor, that's for goddamn sure. There were some bad scenes.
Thanks for being here, Kirk.
Whoa, yeah.
Can you do that already? I don't know.
You can. You can do that. That's the new...
I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy that you're here. Congratulations on your new book, Rules for Werewolves. It's a beautiful novel.
It is my life's dream to have a book in bookstores, and now I do. And I'm going to retire. I've done everything I wanted to do.
Really?
Yeah.
So young.
Good night.
And you've done it. Well done. And, you know, they're not in bookstores for long because people are buying them so quickly.
Oh, yeah. It's nice to see them go.
Yeah. There's been a lot of great response to it. I love it.
Yeah. It's doing nice in the world. I'm very happy. It's so strange. I once interviewed the author Ben Marcus when his first book came out, and he said it was so strange to have books where he couldn't get them back from people, that when he was, before he was published, he knew who had his stories.
Yeah.
And now just anybody could have it. So it's nice to have it sort of running out there in the wild and see it around, or friends text me pictures of it, or, you know, it's great.
That is nice. It's like seeing your children at parties that you didn't know they were attending.
Exactly.
What are they doing there?
What are they doing? Why is he in...
At San Francisco. Maine. I didn't even know
that. Yeah. You shouldn't be in Maine. It's fun, yeah.
Yeah. Would you do us the honor of reading us a section from...
Yeah. This is chapter 23. It's called Angel and Craig Get Married. Mm. If you decide to stay with me, we'll have a big family. We'll move out to the country. We'll live off the land. We'll grow corn all around the house in every direction to make a green wall. We'll keep goats that will train to eat only weeds in among the corn. Old farmers will laugh and tell us it's not possible till they see the way we train them. When a goat kid bends its neck for a weed, we'll pet it. But if it opens its mouth for an early stalk of corn, we'll slap it on the face. We'll take the time to make the kids learn. We'll perfect nature. We'll keep bees without a mask. When the mailman comes, he'll cry to see us standing there in a cloud of bees, perfectly understood by our insects. Unstung. A honeycomb in each hand, offering him the opportunity to join us. Offering him a handful of gold if he can only get over his fear and reach out. Honeycomb and a cup of black coffee in the morning. We'll get a lot of mail because people will write to us for advice. That's what I want to do for a living. I want to give advice. Big picture or little details. I want to be the person people come to. How should I live? In perfect nature. What should I eat? Raw meat and vegetables. Honey. Coffee. Cigarettes are good for you because tobacco is native to this place. Put money in the next envelope you send me if you like my advice. Does he love me? Does he make you come? It only takes time and attention. If you love something, make it come. I love coffee. I pour the cream in real slow to watch it swirl. I let the honey drip down into it from a mile above. If I have whiskey, I put in a finger to warm the coffee up. I expect the same from a man. And you can expect the same from me towards you if you decide to stay. What time should I wake up? As often as you can. Your mind should want to be awake. If you have a dream, you should wake up right away and write it down and send it to us to read. That'll be our only TV, reading America's dreams to one another. You can read everything from east of the Mississippi, and I'll take the west. If you decide to stay with me, those will be our subjects. We'll teach our children to read from these dream letters. We'll teach them spelling and psychology and geography. Imagine raising children on nothing but letting them play outdoors and reading to them from a big compendium of dreams. If those were the only two sources of input they were allowed, running around and listening to mom and dad read dreams, perfect nature. And we'll have lots of children. We'll have 7 children. We'll have 3 girls and 3 boys and 1 that's just wild. We'll set it loose the day it's born. We'll put out food at night on the back porch. We'll lie awake in bed at night and listen to it while we eat, holding one another, proud, frightened. The 7th child will be a test of our faith in perfect nature. At any moment, it could break into the house and kill us all, eat the children, fuck me to death while it fights you back from saving me, but that won't happen. We'll trust in perfect nature, and the 7th child will be kind to us and the goats. We'll test the rest of the brothers and sisters. We'll tell them, you have another sibling, out there somewhere, running wild but close enough to keep an eye on you. And we'll say, your father and I believe, if you decide to stay with me, that this other sibling, in perfect nature, if you ever get in real danger, come with me. We'll break down the door to save you. That's why I spent all this time training you, breaking you, preparing you to make this decision, so that when you decide to stay with me, it can be perfect nature and we can come together forever. Amen.
That was Kirk Lynn reading from his new novel, Rules for Werewolves. Kirk, you said that it was your dream. That's a beautiful section, by the way. I'm glad you chose that section. That's one of my favorite sections.
It's got everything I like in it. It's got sex, it's got danger, it's got prayer, it's got everything good.
It's got feral children.
Feral children, which I have, yeah.
But it is one of those sections, too. There's a number of sections in here that ring out as poetry. I mean, you've got some sections that are well, many of that are dialogue and read like a script, and then but without any action lines, which is a pretty good trick. And then some sections like that, which are just poetry, and it's beautiful. I love how those different styles all kind of combine together.
Yeah.
But before we jump into all the different styles, you mentioned right at the top, you said it was always your dream to have a book in a bookstore. How long has that been your dream? When did that start?
Oh, I think, when I was a kid, when I would spend the night at my friend's house, I would convince them all that we should make books, and we would write and draw books. I remember quite well this book called Kick the Soccer Ball, where there's this soccer ball that was getting kicked and didn't like it. So they were sort of like just stupid fun entertainments. I don't know why I was so drawn to books, but I always have been.
Did you grow up in like a house full of books?
My mom was a Montessori teacher and taught me to read, and I had an older brother and sister, I think, and I shared a room with my brother, which I think in some ways helped direct me toward the in some ways the space of privacy or my own place in the world was really inside books. And so I think that just, like so many kids, that escapist sense of like, when you've got a good book, it still feels like this at 43, that if I can get inside a book that and be away from the world, it feels so beautiful.
Yeah.
And so I think, I think that way in books were really important to my mother, and she read to us all the time. And I remember her reading The Secret Garden to my sister, but I was hanging out with them. And that was a book where I felt like, oh, I'm on the inside of this. When this book starts going, I leave the place I'm at and go inside that book. And so I always just wanted that. And then I think growing up, living in Austin especially, bookstores were places that I still get a real charge. I hope you're the same way, where I get 50% like I want to buy everything and read it, and 50% of me is pissed off. Like, I could write this. I feel energized and aggressive and everything at the same time. I love bookstores.
I'm the same way. Yeah. They are a place of solace and a place of wonderful frustration.
Yeah, it's like a church. You're like half goaded toward, being a better person, and half of you is just wants to escape and live and be sort of comforted there. Yeah.
Yeah. I love how you say that, like, even today, books are a place that you can escape from the world and go into. In some ways, it's like being a teenage runaway and finding an empty house. And you're like, oh, let's go into this one and I can escape from the outside world. And
Yeah. I mean, I think for so many people, life is even, no matter how well off you are, I think that life can be a complicated place emotionally, and any place where you've, I mean, some people find that escape in their relationships and their marriages with their kids, and their work, certainly. But all those little escapes, which turn out to be the actual world in so many ways.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, so, sometimes the things they're escaping, like, that's just the stress. That's just, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, let me ask you, you had this dream, wanting to write a book, mm-hmm. But you're most well known as a playwright, mm-hmm. and one of the founders of Rude Mex here in Austin, which is, you know, internationally respected for your plays. And that was, what, 20 years ago, right, when you guys...
Yeah, which I think next year is our 20th anniversary, yeah. So 20 years together. Yeah. It's amazing.
So how did you find yourself finding playwriting? How did you move into playwriting?
I mean, so, you know, as long as I can remember, I wrote. And I wrote a lot of poetry and I wrote a lot of stories. And I was an undergrad here at the University of Texas. And I was lonely. And I had the conscious thought, if I wrote plays, I would have friends. and so it was almost like a plan. And I wrote a play and a bunch of friends came over. And I think we all got sauced on terrible jug red wine. But in some ways, like way led on to way that it's, I think it's true that theater happens in community and that I've been blessed. I mean, I got what I wanted and then some. The idea that I would be in this like committed artistic relationship / you know, possibly queer marriage to the same people for 20 years.
Yeah.
Has been fantastic. And it's also great. You know, the curse part of it is that none of them are impressed by me. They see through my bullshit. They know my weaknesses, my bad habits, which is great as an artist to have people who keep you honest and are that close with you. I think when you want to change, I think for each of us that we've been together for 20 years, that when we want to change and be new, you have to convince one another to let you be a new person too, which so it has its own, I mean, it's like any marriage where it has its own like, you know, inertia to it too.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't, you know, I basically wouldn't have any friends if I didn't have the Rude Mex. I mean, I'd have my children, you know, like they're not just some friends that I've been with for 20 years, but in some ways they're my entire world that I've been with for 20 years.
Yeah.
And they've seen me through, I mean, I was a total wreck and a mess until about the age of 33. And so they've seen all sides of me. We were joking about the world, you know, like the Rude Mex have seen both sides of me, whereas like my students today have only seen the healthy, reasonable Kirk. Professor Lin, yeah. They lack a little a richness of knowledge of who I was, yeah.
I've heard you talk before about your as a young man being sort of enamored with Kerouac.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bukowski and some of the other.
Yeah.
Did you describe it as poetry written on bad wine?
Yeah, I did a lot of that. I was a huge Kerouac fan. I was obsessed with On the Road, and I would read On the Road over and over again. And there came a day when I read it, and I suddenly realized how sad it was.
Hmm.
And I think it's meant to be sad. I think in a lot of ways that I was sort of willfully misunderstanding it or only letting myself understand a portion of it. But when you look, you know, I've read everything Kerouac wrote. And when you read his early stuff that's more sort of an imitation of Tom Wolfe, and you get the sense that he understands that that sadness or that elegiac part of America that he's participating in. I don't think he wanted to just be around for kicks, but I think I wanted to only eat it that way for a long time.
Yeah.
And then you don't, you know, I was a drunk and I was having a great time, but I never wanted to see the sadness that I was causing either for myself or for other people. And only when you see the full picture do you become a real human being. It's like I was like Pinocchio and I wanted to be a real boy. And the real boy has to admit that not only is he doing damage, but also in the same way that Kerouac, like the fullness of the sadness of not having a family or not having a place or feeling unmoored. And Pinocchio should not write bad poetry drunk on wine. Pinocchio should stop.
Pinocchio should stop. Yeah. That's really fascinating. You know, I have similar relationships with Kerouac.
Yeah.
Of just an early fascination that continues today. I'm still a Kerouac nut, and but a real growing understanding of how sad so much what he writes is. I just recently finished reading the Ginsberg Kerouac letters.
Oh wow!
And some of those letters just made me cry because I was seeing a man's life kind of deteriorate and his I think his artistic sensibilities and I think largely due to alcohol.
Yeah.
I think, you know, a lot of
And Ginsberg is able to pilot, I mean, doesn't have the same burden of addiction, but Ginsberg is able to pilot also the fame and the, you know, the access to sex and to joy, and to also keep his work habits up. Like, it's a, you know, the famous interview where Kerouac is like angry at Ginsberg, like, they don't put this on you, they put this all on me. I mean, Kerouac wasn't a very good Sherpa for a movement, that's for sure.
Right.
I think he felt accused and unable to sort of carry out his work.
Yeah.
But I think even his late novels are quite, like, he has so much talent and so much ability.
Big Sur is a great example of that. Like, Big Sur is, you know, that late novel where you're like, oh gosh, you're there. This great soul and this great knack of language.
Yeah. Maybe because I'm a dude, I think so often the parallel between artists and athletes and the way in which you take care of your, you know, your instrument, or like, are you well trained? Are you fit? Are you able for the, and there's plenty of athletes who, especially, you know, a few years ago, you know, would party on the weekends and would behave inappropriately, not inappropriately only in the sense, and they're not getting the fullness of what they are able to achieve out of their bodies. And I think writers can be that same way, that like, I think Kerouac got confused between how he got access to his voice. Mm. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, I think ends up stealing from us what he's able to do. We don't have, I don't think we have his best work.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was thinking about knowing some of your love of Kerouac, and I was thinking about that when I was reading Rules for Werewolves, and I was thinking, there's a similarity of a movement here. You know, although the sort of beat movement of what if we give up everything that America represents and we forge our own life?
Yeah.
And we do. We live in the vacated or temporarily vacated homes in American suburbia. And
Oh, that's great. I don't know that I had ever consciously thought of the connection between sort of, I mean, I certainly feel this connection to the Western and the idea of like, how do we escape and go to a new land and make new places? And I think we've run out of land and we have to find new ways to live. But, you know, Kerouac's up against that same issue of like, there's nowhere left to go. And in some ways, they travel in an interior way, too.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
You're listening to KUT's The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. I'm Owen Edgerton, and today we're talking with novelist and playwright Kirk Lynn about his debut novel, Rules for Werewolves. I was actually wondering, what was the origin story with this idea? How did you tap into the story of a group of young people, teenagers and older, who move from vacated house to house in suburbia?
I think I started writing this basically around the time when I quit drinking, and I was really seduced by the metaphor of the werewolf, of somebody who wants to change so badly that they're willing to undergo a sort of violent transformation. I mean, I don't know how everybody else's alcoholism is, but mine I think manifests in this way where it seemed like I wanted to go wild. I wanted to be insane, and I could get there. I could take this magic potion and could become another creature. And so it was a way for me to wrestle and to think about that metaphor. In the book, I think, you know, you can decide for yourself. I think ultimately, in some ways, being a werewolf is a really positive thing. I'm not a person who... I mean, I drive an SUV and I live in a house and I have two kids and I am a professor, and yet I still feel this urge to live outside the bounds of normalcy. I want to be, I want my heart and my soul to experience the world in rich and insane ways. I mean, when I play with my children, I want to be a child again. When I'm, you know, a husband for my wife, I want to be the best husband. I always want to be like crazy being, basically. And so I think you can finding ways to sort of get out of yourself and to be in the world and to be with people is essential to me. So I think it was seductive and sexy to me to start writing where somebody would start telling someone else, I'm a werewolf, or you're going to see me change, or it's like a threat and a promise. And then from there, figuring out what the narrative was. And, you know, I grew up in suburbia. I constantly, you know, in high school, we would go drink in houses that were abandoned or were for sale or hadn't been moved into yet. They were great spaces to sort of, you know, we weren't I think that we were respectful of those spaces. I'm sure the owners wouldn't say so. We never trashed anything or broke anything, but we just wanted our own house. We wanted our own space. And that seems like a fair request of a land of plenty. Certainly if they're going to cut down the wilderness, then we can live in the spaces that are left behind, that are, you know, that take over that wilderness. So I think all of that sort of coming together.
When you said you stopped drinking, how long ago was that?
I think a little more than 10 years now.
Yeah.
It drives my wife crazy. I never remember the date. I always want to like celebrate the anniversary, but I don't actually remember the date. So yeah, I don't know, 10 years or so. Yeah.
So when you were talking about the idea of a werewolf, it was interesting. You just said kind of two different things. So when you started that conversation, like undergoing a painful transformation in mm-hmm. order to change, wanted to change so much. I thought you were talking about going through the process of stop drinking.
Yeah.
But then you also talked about how drinking was a magic potion that would allow you to transform.
Yeah.
Is it sort of both? Is it two-sided?
Yeah, I think it is both. I think it is both. I mean, it's some, you know, one thing drunks are good at is making sobriety their new obsession, their new addiction. You know, like you find other ways to transform yourself. I mean, you know, I just ran a half marathon with Steve Moore. He ran the whole marathon. I ran half of it. But I mean, that like training for running is a way in which you like physically change your body. It takes great labor. It takes great work. And you're doing something to yourself. You know, working on your sobriety, I think meditation, I think all these things are, you know, replace the essential task, which is to escape oneself. But escape oneself to be in the world, maybe rather than one's head. I think in some ways I'm a bad sober person in that I feel conflicted about just about everything in the world. I can see both sides. Like I would never encourage anybody to be an alcoholic. That's for sure. But if you said, did anything good happen? I would say, God, yeah, so many great things happened. It was a fantastic time. And I still, you know, I sometimes look back longingly on those, you know, those days were wild and crazy. I wouldn't give them up, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, but I'm not going to do it again. So, you know, yeah.
I mean, I wonder if that's a little bit, it's interesting. You're talking about like when you're playing with your kids, you want to be a kid. You're there all the way. You're playing. Yeah. And then when you're with your wife, you're like, I'm going to be all here.
Yeah.
And maybe that even goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. You have a brilliant way of stepping into a voice, and your book is full of that. Uh-huh. You know, it moves from voice to voice, point of view to point of view. And I was recognizing that as you as a playwright of being able to more than anything else incorporate a character through the voice of the dialogue. But I also wonder if maybe that's part of your personality too, of like where if you're going to be writing about a character, you're going to be in that character's head and in that spot.
What it feels like to me on the inside, piloting the weird machine that is Kirk, is that I think I'm so much of a formalist that I really want if I'm working on a play or when I'm working on a novel, that the form of the novel needs to tell me how to write it. So when I was writing werewolves at first and I was writing normal prose, it just wasn't working. But when I hit like, oh, I should do it all dialogue, like setting down those formal rules, it started flowing.
Huh.
I think the same thing when I do a play, when I'm like, oh, I'm going to do this all in stage directions, or this is only going to be made out of questions. I have a play that I just wrote only questions that you ask the audience and let them answer. And this formal, I hear friends who say that their characters speak to them, or I know that famous story of Rilke basically felt like the Duino elegies were sort of recited to him by whispered to him by an angel, yeah. And he just wrote it down.
Yeah.
I'd love to someday feel that. I don't think that that's how it works for me. That I really struggle and need to address the form and have the form speak back to me in some way. But then later I do feel like, I mean, I love voice. I love these characters. I end up sort of loving everybody, even the more miserable the character. I mean, Angel is so violent and hateful, and I want her to be full of poetry and seduction and sex. And I think that's her gift that she gets for being so outside the norm.
Hmm.
She can see things. She can see an ideal world that one would never want to live in.
Right.
And yet she wants to live in it, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the book is full of characters who are trying to find that right spot just outside of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And balancing it. It's like there's a constant balance with chaos
yeah.
in
yeah.
there.
I mean, I think the world – I mean – It's probably too... Just to maybe piss somebody off who's listening to this. I mean, I think the world by and large is a horrible place. And the idea, even the great life that I've had where I have all the money and all the food, nothing's ever been denied me, it feels like. I'm probably the richest person on earth. And still, like, you know, having to work at a Baskin Robbins or having to work, I had to work at a TJ Cinnabon. Like, the world is just it's just structured in this totally dumb way. And people have to work at a Walmart or work at a place where they burn medical waste. Like, there's so many terrible things that you have to do.
Uh-huh.
And we've messed up everything. It feels like the idea that you want to somehow live in harmony with the earth is like, I don't know that it's strictly capitalism, but basically we scoff at that person. Like, what a joke. You need to go back to your job burning medical waste or whatever you have to do, grading freshman essays. That's my equivalent of burning medical waste. And it's hard. And so when you find those moments of like, this is just outside that, and I feel like I have a space where I can feel whole and feel present, I think those things are holy in the best way possible.
Where do you find those spaces?
I mean, probably when I sleep. I don't know. I mean, I think so much time, like, I meditate every day. I'm terrible at it. Most of that is actually, it feels like training, like right when I finish the half marathon, there's this great feeling for like 15 seconds where like, yeah, that was great.
That's, and I met that's this, when I vomit. But.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, probably the best part of running the half marathon was I met this guy and we ran together for a while. And that like 2.5 minutes was probably the best part, meeting a stranger and talking to him about why we were there and what we were doing. That was probably the only, you know, and then the first, I probably just insulted my friend Steve Moore. Steve Moore and I ran together for an 11 and a half miles and just talked for an 11 and a half miles.
Oh, nice.
And then he went off on the marathon route. So that's all to say, I think a student of mine just wrote this sentence where she said that nobody wants to want, they want to have. And my initial reaction was like, no, longing is so satisfying. Longing is fantastic.
Yeah.
And so often the anticipation is better. You know, my wife and I have a date night coming up Sunday night where my parents will come up and take care of the kids. And just that anticipation all week is super romantic and super fun. And, you know, date night will either go well or it won't go well. But the longing, I think, is really healthy. And the same thing with, you know, we're prepping for Christmas with the kids and all their longing and our longing for their, you know, trying to make it a great Christmas, but also we don't want to go crazy. Like, just get the perfect present, you know, that moment. Like, that's so exciting. Seeing their anticipation is so great. So I think a lot of my joy in the world is in longing, is in work. I mean, I think one of the weirdest things as a writer is that writing the book is so much more fun than anything else.
I completely agree. You know, I don't even know who said it, the cliche of like, I love having written.
Yeah, yeah.
I despise writing.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody, yeah, I can't remember who said it. Yeah.
And
yeah.
For me, I'm always flabbergasted by that. I'm like, no one's forcing you to do that. It doesn't pay that well.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Oh, I say that all, I couldn't agree more. I think if writing is unpleasant to you, don't do it.
Yeah.
There's too many books anyway.
Right. We don't need it. Yeah.
I mean, probably everyone should quit writing. And then we still can't read everything that's out there.
We should just play catch up for 100 years or so.
I read this great thing. It was Jean-Luc Godard said that we should not look at any culture past 1968, and we should wait till we sort of have absorbed and caught up with everything from 68 prior, and then we can go forward. I like, you know, and I think that's bought. I think that pleasure in the writing is bought by the days when you feel like, I don't know how to do it. I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, a novel to me more than a novel is to me in some ways more precious than a play, because you have to keep the faith for so much longer that every day you meet this moment where you say, this is stupid. It doesn't really work. Werewolves are stupid. This doesn't really touch my actual longing for my wife or children. It doesn't speak to my love of Chekhov. It's just it's a strange book. And you have to keep meeting all those voices that say, this is not a good idea. This won't work. And you have to say, well, I'll keep going anyway, because maybe there's something there, or there's something for me, or there's something for someone like me. The duration of that is over the course of years rather than over the course of either days or weeks. And I think when you get to the end of that duration, and you meet something, I'm happy to say that, when I sold the book and I had to reread it to do edits, which was a few years after I wrote it, I was like, oh my God, I like this book.
Yeah.
I want to be with this book. And I think that's that moment of talking to that stranger on the marathon run of like, oh, this is a happy little respite in the midst of just trying and doubting and feeling awkward.
You know, that's you say a lot of truth there. I it's a funny thing. And Sarah Hepla on the show and talking about her memoir, Blackout, talks about sometimes writing is inspired and wonderful and you're feeling intense. And then sometimes it's just moving rocks across a room.
Yeah.
And then you go back and you pick up another rock. And you do. You have to have this trust that eventually something's going to be built out of these rocks, but right now you can't see it. And for me, with novel writing, in a different way than writing a skit or a monologue or a screenplay even, with those I can kind of – I sense the overall. I can hold it. I can hold this hour and a half movie. I get it. But with a novel, at some point in the middle, like – I can't hold it all. I don't remember everything, or feel it all,
And the love and attention you have to give, like a small change needs to be, I call it combing out. You have to go back through the entire book and make sure that this rings out through every, in every section, and that it doesn't. I mean, there's the simple problem of like, does this contradict something, or is this counterfactual to other things I've set up? But there's the more loving of like it. Is this ringing out correctly against a scene that if I spend a little bit more time, I'll find a scene in the first two pages where you can parallel it. And, for the person who's paying attention will feel this wholeness, will feel the unity. Cause you can't hold it in your mind. You can't know. And in that way you get to meet yourself, I think, in some ways, in a way that you don't necessarily get to meet yourself, in a work that you can hold all of. You forget that you wrote certain sections or how things played out. And it's a pleasure then to get to see how those things, what you intended, what you mistook.
To meet yourself. Was that your experience when you were rereading for revisions after you sold the book?
Yes. Yeah. If you had asked me to describe it, I probably would have not captured any, I think like that Angel section that I read, which I'm fond of, I like, if it's not too vain to say, I would never have remembered that I ever had a woman longing to, have wild children and the notion that she is, quite pompously, like her job that she wants in the world is to give people advice for money is such a great, character trait, but I don't remember conceiving that, that's for sure. And so it's nice to meet that moment and be like, oh, and then just I like the honey and the coffee, like all the sensual things. Again, if I don't remember writing it, so it's fun to come across and be like, oh, wow, that's a great, who thought of that? I like that guy.
I like this writer.
Oh, well, that guy's me. I like me. You can have 5 minutes. Because I think most writers know, or probably most people know, that there's so much in your head where you're like, oh, I sounded stupid. I mean, even through this whole podcast, they're like, my self-dialogue is like, oh, I sound stupid, I'm not paying attention, like those moments when human beings get to not be in that loop and can be in the loop of like, oh, this is fun, I'm having pleasure, that's good.
Yeah.
Stop talking.
You're listening to The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. By coincidence, I am Owen Edgerton, and we are here at the KUT studios in beautiful Austin, Texas, and we're talking to novelist and playwright Kirk Lynn. Kirk, I wanted to ask you, of course, you've written over a dozen plays and have worked in producing many plays. With a play, there's the audience. There's the immediate interaction that the words have with people who are there setting a tone and almost collaborating, not only with the plays that you've written where they are actually collaborating, actually interacting with the actors verbally, but even just their presence. How is it different than with a novel, which is a individual alone with these marks on a page?
I mean, one of the things I'm struck by is that novels get consumed in the same way that they get created. So plays get created over long amounts of time at stops and starts, and the order might get changed, and you pick them up and put them down, you go home and hang out with your family, but they get consumed at one sitting over a single moment in time, and there's a different kind of clock on it. Whereas novels get picked up and put down in the same way that they get composed.
Huh.
I'm a little suspicious of the way plays were, I think that playwright, I think myself, I get, I long for people to laugh. That's a way in which the audience can instantly tell me that that it's working, that I'm connecting with them. And I don't know that I want to be a funny person. I think I spend so much of my life clowning around. I've been, my father, who is a barber, and I learned to tell jokes from him, and I learned to show affection through teasing. I think sometimes that gets in the way of saying anything that you want to say sincerely. And I think novels can, the reader can react how they want to react. They don't get influenced too much by the other people around them. I mean, people can tell them that something's a funny book or not. But alone in their room, they have to decide which bits are funny and which bits are sincere. And I have a tendency to speak in ways that, a lot of times people tell me they don't know, like they assume that I'm being funny and they just laugh. Uh-huh. And I'm often not being funny. I'm just being me. Right. And so I think the book lets that voice be a little more, I mean, the book's funny and totally weird.
Yeah.
But the longing to like be in nature and to have a bunch of kids, like all those are real. And while they're strange, they're real. And I think the book carries the, novels can carry that voice better.
That's
maybe.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. There is something in a play or a film, specifically though, more and more people watching movies alone too, but anything that's watched with an audience, there is something like, it needs to be very clear. No, I'm asking for this response in some ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, movies are, especially Hollywood movies, are famous for that. They're going to have a soundtrack that is going to tell you, this is how you should feel about this.
Yeah.
And if something, yeah, you're asking for a response like laughter or something. And there's not a lot of room, or it seems there's a different sort of feel of that in between of like, this is funny and not funny simultaneously. This is sincere and mixed. And where a novel, it does probably allow for more of that. Vagueness is not the right word.
I would almost say, so my mind's spinning off now in this direction. For someone who writes, I'm also very I think language is a bad container for our actual thoughts and emotions, and that something like anger or love are not things that we feel ever purely. And so we put like, this is funny. I feel funny about this. I feel like laughing, but often our laughter also has sadness, or our anger also has affection in it. And I think forms that allow people to make their own decisions sometimes let more of those layers ring out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm somebody who, for somebody who goofs around all the time, I don't watch or like a lot of comedies. And the comedies that I do like are often the ones that, like The British Office, where they're really tinged with that sadness and awkwardness. They seem more human to me. That's the kind of, I take great pleasure in that because it feels like my life. Whereas silliness, I'm silly all the time, but I don't, you know, I don't like a lot of silliness, I guess.
Yeah. No, I'm a similar way. Like my comedy, if I'm watching comedy, it's got to hurt.
Yeah. 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 I want Louis C.K. to talk to me about how we should actually be in the world. And then we're laughing as we're feeling great pain. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. That's a great feeling.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting also, there's an aspect too of when we're reading that even you were talking about how, you know, I'm on this podcast and we're talking and I'm already having a dialogue inside my head about the things I'm saying out loud.
Yeah.
How often we're having this sort of constant dialogues.
Yeah.
And a mixture of voices. I was wondering, you know, in werewolves, there's so many different voices and they create this beautiful harmony and disharmony. Which of the voices like came through for you as like, oh, this is leading the way. This is driving it.
Let's see. The young man, there's a boy named Bobbert who doesn't like his nickname. He's Robert and he's been nicknamed Bobbert. And he's probably the character that I feel the most affinity for. He never knows how to, he doesn't know how to be brave. He doesn't know how to be violent. He doesn't know how to be wild, and yet he's really drawn to these people he needs to get out of his life and out of his home. And the moment he comes into the sort of self-actualization and fully is himself is the moment when he has to change in order to essentially save his brother. And that feeling that for someone else, I'll become someone different. I mean, when I had kids, the chair of my department at our first meeting after that, because suddenly I was like, I need a bunch of money and I need it now. He said to me, he said, you talk to me differently now that you've had a kid. And my thought was like, Absolutely. My relationship to the world has changed. I'm now responsible to someone in a way I have. It's the first kind of new relationship I've had. You know, I've had friends, I've had lovers, and then a wife is a version of that. And I've had all these relationships before, but suddenly I have this new relationship that I don't have any analog for. And all I know is I've got to take care of this person in some way.
Yeah.
And that really, I think, drove a kind of transformation in me. I mean, I'd already sobered up, but the idea that now it wasn't just a lark that I had to sort of not, I don't think it just translated into one of the easier ways to market is to say I needed to make X amount of money. So I felt like I was taking care of my child. But I do think there's a change in the way of like, I want to speak in a way that, in my artwork, I want to speak in a way that my children can see, the way in which I wanted to engage with the world or what I thought about the world. And I think that changed the kind of art I was making.
Did you feel you were making art that you were aware your children would one day read or see?
Yeah, I think in a way. I mean, I don't think I've spent too much time thinking about my daughter literally reading it, but knowing that the kind of work that I make speaks to who I really want to be. I guess I think before I had kids, it was like, oh, I don't mind being silly, or I don't mind being I didn't have to fully represent myself in some way. And now I feel like I want to be seen as myself. I want to be seen. And so when my kids will see that person when I walk in the house, they'll be like, oh, there's that dude. That dude who thinks he knows something.
I'm horrified about what my kids will find.
I'm so excited. I'm so excited.
They've already seen some. They've heard some stories about shows I've done. And
yeah. Just the idea that I think any good writer is probably highly self-critical, right? You can't trust yourself. You have to be doubting in terms of like what am I able to do, and am I getting my best performance? Am I getting my best work? And I think kids are great at helping you get to that place. Like kids know that you don't know anything, and they're totally willing to test until they can really find what you actually know, you know?
Yeah.
Like, just about things like, you know, do you have to wear a coat today? That's a current struggle that we're going through.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
They're going to push until the very moment where you're like, no, nothing is happening until you put this coat on. They're like, oh, okay, he really means it.
Yeah.
We'll do it. All right. And having that constant pressure is so great.
So you have two children, and you're married to Carrie Fountain.
Who's a fantastic poet. Yeah,
she's the best award-winning poet. Yeah. She's one of my favorite poets writing today. And I wonder what's that like? What's the literary home life? I'm married to a poet too.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I mean, Carrie and I say to each other, we don't hang out with a lot of writers, I don't think, and we don't really talk about writing too much.
Except we invite you over all the time,
and we will
never show up.
Yeah. We do have a brunch that's failed, don't we?
We did.
Ongoing brunch date that's moving down the calendar.
Yes.
I don't know that it'd be interesting to know. I don't think Carrie thinks of me as a writer.
What now?
I think she thinks of me as her husband. I mean, it's totally weird to say, but...
you two don't find yourselves talking about
language. We talk about the work, and we talk about, like, faithfulness. The ups, the emotional ups and down, but almost in the same way that somebody who's like a marathon runner would talk, or an athlete. Are you going to the gym today? You need to go to the gym. But we don't talk about inside the work very much. We usually, I think almost without exception, are each other's first reader.
Yeah.
I think we are not, we're in no way precious. Again, like having the Rude Mechs there, it's nice to have people who don't, think too much of you. I know that Carrie adores me, and I think for that reason she can say anything she wants to, and I trust her. She doesn't need to impress me about anything, and she also is totally not impressed by me. And I think vice versa. I think she knows that any critique I have is because I rely on her work to feed me as a reader. I mean, it's interesting. I feel like I'm a reader of Carrie Fountain, but I don't really hang out with her as a writer. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Writing, like, process. Are you a morning writer, day writer, night writer?
I'm an early morning writer, and sort of always have been ever since I got off my Kerouac phase. Once the drinking of bad wine and the writing of terrible poetry about how free and hip I was left me, I became an early morning writer. And then once I had kids, it became this like essential, I wake up before the kids wake up and I write until Olive jumps out of bed and runs to get me.
You write at home.
I write at home, yeah.
Yeah.
And I can feel the clock, and that last 5 minutes is a lot of times when I get some of my best writing done, because I'm like, oh, she's just about to wake up. I need to finish this thought. But I tell you what, I don't think there's not a single thing that I like that sound when I hear she doesn't. She goes balls out everywhere. She just like makes so much noise. And that's always such a like, I feel enthusiastic and giddy when I hear her. She's like, oh, we're done for the day. Here it comes. And it's hilarious. It's so much fun. I wake up really early. I really believe in the notion that, you know, you do a little bit of work every day and it adds up. I don't think I'm not prolific in that I don't write, 2,000 words a day. I write a little bit every single day and I just bang away at it.
Yeah.
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 I believe in, just attending.
I remember reading that you will do what you call finger exercises, like a piano player, something to get the words moving.
I think I met that first with the writer Thomas Bernhardt describing like these really short stories that he wrote as finger exercises, because he was also a pianist. But so many of the works that I absolutely adore are these really short things. Do you know there's a guy, if I've given nothing to the world, I find this is the moment where I meet myself in the podcast and say, I Remember by Joe Brainard, I think is the work that has fed me the most.
Yeah.
Visual artist who ended up over the course of his entire life writing sentences that just start, I remember. And then he talks about when Coke bottles were green. He remembers the first time that he wore a woman's dress. He's a queer artist who grew up in Oklahoma and moved to New York and became really hip in the downtown art scene. And he talks about these, I mean, essentially tells a really simple story in a single sentence of something that he remembers. And that kind of, for a while, I tried to make a list of everything I ever believed. Mm. I was really interested in faith and writing down everything I had ever believed about the world and about God. There's another book called Novels in Three Lines, where this guy, a French guy, tried to summarize these really sensational newspaper stories in the sort of ragtag newspapers that are all about, you know, criminal gamblers shooting each other and killing themselves. And he boils them down to three lines, and that's a really beautiful book. So I love sort of aphoristic moments like that, and I try and keep touch. One of the ways that I try and keep myself limber is by doing a lot of small exercises like that early in the morning. It also, when I wake up, I know what I'm going to do. So I just start doing one of those strange little exercises. Then I get to the big work sort of later in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you drink coffee.
I drink a lot of coffee.
Me as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's any reason that you should not. I read somewhere too that there's no reason to even cut back on coffee. Coffee's good for you. You should drink as much as you want. And if you have trouble sleeping, just don't drink the last cup that you drink every day, if that makes sense.
Was this in like Starbucks Monthly?
Exactly.
You read this?
Yeah, I read this. Yeah.
Insightful piece.
I'm telling people, coffee is good for you.
Yeah.
You're having a cup now, but I'm not having a cup.
I noticed that.
I'm so angry.
We can probably get you a cup.
All right.
We'll see. It depends how well you do for the rest of the podcast.
All right.
If you do well,
I'll do my best.
You earn a cup of coffee. Let me ask you, you mentioned that you were exploring a faith through some of these exercises, some of these thought processes. And I've noticed that's something that your work touches on and that your wife, Carrie Fountain's work touches on. And you've mentioned already today meditation being a daily practice for you.
Mm-hmm.
What aspects of faith do affect your writing?
I had a kind of sad summer. I told a friend of mine that I sort of regretted that I wasn't smart enough to be religious. I wish I was smart enough to have a faith. I think I'm sort of a bad Buddhist.
Hmm. So far you've said it. You're a bad Buddhist. You're a bad sober guy.
I know. I'm terrible at everything.
Yeah.
I'm a good dad. I'm a good husband.
Nice.
I'm a pretty good friend, I think. And then after that, things start going downhill. Yeah. But those are all right.
So what do you mean you're a bad Buddhist?
I mean, I'm unwilling to sort of commit I mean, I meditate every day. I certainly believe that the meditation is an end unto itself. I think it is necessary that I learn to have compassion for myself and then for the world. The voice inside me, the dialogue I have is I should start going to sit at the Sangha and be more, read the sutras and be more engaged. And when I balance that against playing with my kids and watching the Best British Bake Off and checking football scores and following the Spurs, like I let the clutter sort of fill my life happily. So I think I'm a bad Buddhist. But some of that might be I was raised Southern Baptist and have this like very judgmental sense about what, how severe religion should be, maybe. I'm very good at not being a Southern Baptist, I feel like.
Oh, yeah?
I'm very successful at that, yeah. I don't think anybody would mistake me for a Southern Baptist at any moment of the day.
Right. But you were raised.
I was raised Southern Baptist, yeah. And still have a great deal of affection. I mean, this is why I feel like I'm not smart enough to be religious. Reading the Gospels, I'm obsessed with this book called the Desert Fathers about these ascetic Christians who lived out in the desert. I'm still quite moved by all those things. But then when I want to apply those to my life, and someone's like, I can't do that. I can't get involved in all that nonsense. So.
I recently read Ken Wilber.
Uh-huh.
Who's a pretty interesting writer, and he wrote in his book and memoir, Grace and Grit. And a funny sort of line, he said he felt that people, to be religious, to have a religious faith, or to believe in God specifically, mm-hmm. you had to be, and these are his words, you had to be either really dumb uh-huh. or very, very intelligent.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. yeah. I'm afraid I'm right in the middle, unfortunately. I don't think I'm very intelligent, and I'm just not quite dumb enough. So it's terrible. I admire people of faith. I long for it. Yeah. There's a scene in No Country for Old Men, the novel, that I think in some like weird way summed up. There's at one point one of the older men says, I always thought that there would be a moment when God would appear in my life and he would become a part of my life. And it just never happened. And the other guy basically says, like, you don't know. And there's something about that, like, I don't know, some idiocy that believes that like maybe it's not even given to me to know one way or the other, just to like try and think about belief and think about faith and be as true as I can to the things I do believe. But I mean, this is a critique of self and a critique of all of culture. I think if you really looked at how I spent my time and my money, that you would have to say that my beliefs are horrible. I worship capitalism in my iPhone and a Subaru and a gasoline. I love those things. That's what I spend my time and attention and money on.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully somewhere high on the list are my children and my wife, my students, my theater company. But in the final tally, I don't think it's going to look very good for anybody.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, actually, that's an idea that fuels Rules for Werewolves.
Yeah. People who long to break out of that system and not to worship those, mammon or whatever you want to call it.
And you seem to me, your works are populated by restless seekers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only as we're talking now that it occurs to me that many of the restless seekers don't quite find what they're looking for.
Yeah, I don't know what it would look like to find what you were looking for. So one of the funny things I'm writing right now, or I think it's funny, is that like it has occurred to me that culture is where we sort of collect our ongoing debates and ideas, but the people who create culture, artists, are the least worthwhile people to describe those things or to engage with those things. That we should fire all artists, and we should ask people like my mother and father, people like my grandparents, to create culture for us, because they're balanced, healthy, honest. Like the idea that you think you have something to say and you're gonna take your time away from doing anything good in the world and just make art, I think automatically disqualifies you as somebody who should be allowed to speak in some ways. It's like anybody who runs for president is so narcissistic and insane that they should never be a leader. I think maybe artists are the same way, that we should, the last people we should listen to are artists. We should destroy all culture.
I think you're onto something. You know, it's funny. I don't, you know, with novels, when I'm writing a novel or something like that,
yeah,
I feel I can let my freak flag fly. Like, you know,
yeah,
it's a novel. What, you know, you're crazy to be reading.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, especially reading me. So yeah. I'm just going to put everything in there.
Yeah, yeah.
But you and I have both had experience working in Los Angeles and Hollywood.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And when you're there, then you're, that's in those meetings, I'm trying to pretend. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know what Americans like.
Yeah, yeah.
Me too. And I realize I don't.
Yeah. The greatest compliment I ever got in my life in some ways was my good friend Peter Stopchinski, composer around town.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
He worked on something with me at UT where I'm a professor, right? And he was sort of flabbergasted and he said, "You act the same way around other professors that you act everywhere else." And I was like, that's the nicest thing anybody's ever said about, like... But I feel like in Hollywood, like, I should just go out to Hollywood and just be like, Hollywood needs to be destroyed. We all need to be, including myself. Nobody should be allowed to do this. Yeah, but they don't want to hear that story.
I don't know. They might, actually. I think you might be onto something there.
Yeah.
I think they want and fear. I mean,
exactly.
I want and fear that, you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Me as well. Yeah.
Yeah. That like outrageous honesty from an individual or from myself even.
Yeah. And then to live that honesty in some way. I think that's where the bad comes in, the bad sobriety, the bad Buddhism of like, I sort of believe that, but you know what? I'm going to keep writing books and I'm going to keep promoting myself as a reasonable human being and teaching classes. God. There's a lot, you know, in the Rude Mex play that we made together, Method Gun, there's a...
This is you and Peter?
This is me in the Rude Mex.
Oh, in the Rude Mex, yes.
There's a description of somebody teaching a class, and every time he turns his back, he has this fantasy that the students are just going to run up and attack him and take over the class. And I think I long for that moment when the students just devour me. I will say, though, Peter was essential to this book in two ways. Early on, I was really debating, like, is where that interior monologue was going on about, like, are werewolves too silly a metaphor? Are they too sort of pop culture? And Peter said to me, I was weighing that and I think the George Washington book that I was working on, and he was like, you should just write the book that you get the most excited by. It seems most fun to you. And I thought, that's great advice. And I followed that. And at the very end of the book, I was really debating how much I wanted to signal, are the werewolves real or not? And Peter said, it's more fun if they're real. So I was like, that's good advice, Peter. So if you have any artistic problems, call Peter Stopchinski.
Do you have his number? Can you just...
Yeah, I know that it's runpms@yahoo.com. Send him a bunch of emails.
Good.
Everybody needs more emails.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton, and we are talking to novelist, playwright, and teacher Kirk Lynn. Kirk, I was wondering, so you're talking about you'd love your students to rise up, and it does seem that... There's a desire, you mentioned this at the beginning, a desire to be wild, desire to just be crazy. What if you did that, like, let's say you had a day, in a day where where the responsibilities including consequences,
uh-huh.
You know, like, what is that? What is the thing that you're seeking? Is it, because even your characters in Rules for Werewolves are kind of experiencing that in a different way. I mean, there's a great scene where they say, well, let's just do everything we want and we'll put into a hat and we'll just choose something random and that aspect. But what is the crazy things that would somehow connect you to nature, to God, to life in its essence?
Oh, I dream all the time. I mean, the most authentic, I think, would be to run away to nature, just to live like an animal. I think that is the...
Like a werewolf.
I think, you know, in the biblical story of Nebuchadnezzar and just like living in the fields and, you know, eating honey, even like living like an actual... Also, why don't animals freeze to death? Like when it snows, where do the cats and the deer go? And how do they hunker down and just be all
under my deck?
Under my... Is that where they all go? The possums?
A bunch of deer live under my deck. That's not true.
Do they?
No, it's not.
So I think to run away, I think, is probably like the fantasy. But then the first thing I thought all these terrible thoughts about like running into stores and smashing things, giving things away, I love to, here's a horrible thing that I do that I think is funny. I'm upset. I like signs that say free. And so when I see people put out their sofa and they have a sign on it that says free, I take the free sign. That's part one. I think that's funny. Horrible. I think that's neat. The more horrible part is it's funny then to hang those signs on things that aren't free. Like as you walk by a Starbucks, just hang that on their little rack that's out with all the students and say, this is free. And then that causes a little chaos in the world that I think is good for everybody.
Do you do this?
Yes, I do this. I think that Starbucks steals from us quite enough and that we should also every once in a while steal a little from them or encourage others to steal from them. I haven't stolen anything. I've given them a sign. I gave them one free thing.
This is a true writer. True writer doesn't break the law. He just encourages other people to do
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And then I didn't even – this is like a true modern artist. I didn't even write the sign free. I just stole that. Like – nothing was composed by me. It's the Duchamp of writing. Yeah.
So, but it would be living in the wild.
I think living in the wild. Yeah. I think living in the wild.
And
I
would disrupting Starbucks.
Yeah. Stealing, living in the wild. I mean, essentially living like the werewolves, I guess. I'd love to take my family and friends. But I mean, I do feel confined by the way. Like the world was made when I was born. So I didn't get to make my own place in it. I had to a certain degree fit into it. And I think slowly as I get more agency in my life, I feel like, oh, I'm learning to, you know, make the university my own, teach the way I want to teach, be a husband and a father and a straight white male in the way that I want to be, you know, as queer and as weird as that can possibly be, and just be myself rather than the mold that's been placed for me. But I don't know how easily that comes to everybody. I am one of these people who feels like at the age of 80, I'll be more authentic than I am now. I feel more authentic at 43 than I did at, you know, 23. So at 83, well, it'll be back to Wangs out at parties.
I'm hoping to be at that party.
You and I. Who wants to be at a party with 83-year-old Owen and Kirk with Wangs out? No one.
We'd just be hanging out.
You and me. It's a two-man party.
Let me ask you, we're nearing the end of the podcast.
We better be,
that
man.
Probably should have just been the ending right there. In the comedy world, you know the final beat and you just missed it. But I did want to ask you, it does seem that you within your career, you have been a shaper of communities. Like you're saying very much so, and I think accurately, that the American culture has these entrapments, whether it be capitalism or false ways of performing and false roles that you feel you have to be in. But you've created like the Rude Mex, which was like, all right, let's be a community that creates in a different kind of way, and then let's invite other people. So even any performance is not only the production itself over the months that it takes, but also the performance is its own kind of mini culture. And then of course you have a family, and then you have a classroom. Mm-hmm. Do you see that sort of expanding a little bit? I mean, is there a way that you kind of go, gosh, there should be a different way of approaching life, and I want to discover that and invite people to seek it together.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's all a big search for somebody who could be in charge of something like that. I wouldn't trust myself to ever be in charge of something like that. But, I mean, I think the Rude Mex, you know, I would almost say less that I made any of that, but that they made a space for me to become myself in a lot of ways. And I love those moments at the Rude Mex and any performance where it seems like you know, I when I was an undergrad, I read this book, Temporary Autonomous Zones by Hakim Bey, and that notion of like this for this amount of time, this space is a place where anything can happen and we're free in some sense. And I think the shows that we have that work give that feeling, create a little force field for a while. And I absolutely, on the best days, feel that with my family when we, you know, when we're just doing whatever it is we're doing. My son's 2.5, and we've invented a game where we pretend that we've fallen down in the forest and we just call out for help. And my wife hates it. My daughter doesn't like it. All we do is lay there and ask for help. And when somebody comes in, we usually pull them down into the forest and cuddle them. Everybody's busy. Nobody has time to be laying in the forest. But it was a game that naturally came about from us just playing and cuddling and rolling. And now it's become, even at 2.5, I can get that he gets it.
Yeah.
That we're annoying people, but it's also funny. And so that's a moment where like we're just with each other, and I hope the classroom works that way sometimes when we destroy everything and we can be new.
You've been listening to Kirk Lynn on KUT's The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. I'm Owen Edgerton. Kirk, thank you so much for being here with us today.
I retract everything I've said. I regret everything, and I love you. Thanks for having me.
The KUT's The Write-Up is recorded at the KUT studios in Austin, Texas. It is produced by the lovely and talented Rebecca McEnroy and engineered by David Alvarez, who is equally lovely and talented. Keep reading and keep listening. Thanks.